That's composer and band leader David Ware on tenor sax with African drums, Matthew Shipp on piano, William Parker on bass, Guillermo Brown on drums. It's from his 1999 album, Surrendered. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we continue from our discussion, which we began yesterday, winding down the year 2015 with your thoughts and observations about what mattered to you and to all of us this year. What we learned, what we accomplished, what still is to be done. The number to call is 888-874-4888 to continue that conversation. And while you do that, we can't help but make some notations here before we go on, and that concerns what is being described as the latest in the development of the shooting death by police of Tamir Rice, 12 years old, who was killed in November 2014 by a police officer who was responding to a call, supposedly, of a person waving a gun in a park. Turned out to be 12-year-old Tamir Rice, and the gun turned out to be a toy gun that he was playing with. And the police officer, as we saw on the videotape, upon arriving on the scene, almost immediately began firing and shot and killed Tamir Rice. Well, this was being described as major news yesterday. Latest development is that a grand jury in Cleveland decided that there was no reason to indict not only the police officer who did the shooting, Timothy Lohman, but also the driver of the cruiser, Frank Garmbach, that there was no reason at all to indict them on any criminal charge. And this, of course, was met with a great deal of concern about rioting and the potential for things to get out of hand in Cleveland. And a couple of things that we should note here. Number one, this was not news. It might have been news in some quarters, but this was not news. If you've been listening to this program, Attorney Alton Maddox had already dissected this case and predicted accurately. We're now batting 100% accuracy in these cases. He predicted the outcome. The outcome was there was going to be no charge. Now, we don't know whether with the grand jury not indicting doesn't mean that this is the end of the case. We don't know whether the case will be re-presented. We don't know what will become of this case. But it is not so much a grand jury's decision that ought to concern us here, as we have discussed in talking about the criminal justice and prosecutorial systems. That's really where we need to look, because that's where the answer is. The answer is in the combination of systems that produce predictable outcomes. Here's Alton Maddox, and I said the same thing. We are clear as to how these cases are manipulated and handled so as to produce a desirable result, that desirable result being no indictment. And in advance of this case, we had the pronouncement by U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch that she would begin in a related case in Chicago, that is the shooting death of Laquan McDonald, the young man who was shot and killed with 16 bullets, that she was very clear that people officers, the main actors, were not going to be the purpose and focus of any investigation that the U.S. Justice Department conducts. So this, too, is predictable. We predicted that right on this program. I did a couple of editorials on that and commentaries on that. It is not because I'm prescient. It's not because I have extrasensory perception. It is simply because I have had the opportunity of covering these kinds of cases over 40 years. And history tells us that this is likely to be the outcome. History and an astute analysis of the legal moves that are being made. We see this all the time. Now, the coverage of this crisis, and that's what it is, it may not be a crisis for, quote, America, unquote, but I can assure you, it is a crisis, and people ought to get to the point of not caring whether, quote, America, unquote, recognizes it as such. If this is a crisis as you define it, then it is a crisis, and I define it as a crisis. I don't care what people are thinking about this. And when you understand this to be a crisis, and you understand the historical context for this, you can't but understand that there is an intention here on several levels to maintain white supremacy in this country, and the police force or police forces all around the country as sharing the burden and the duty and the obligation of maintaining that status quo. This is, after all, despite all of the talk you hear about, you know, how far we have come and all this nonsense, this is an apartheid country. It hasn't changed. And the system, even as espoused by an African-American man in the top position in this country to create some change and make some moves, bold moves, to reorder things. I'm talking about Eric Holder, the former U.S. Attorney General, the African-American, and the current U.S. Attorney General, an African-American woman. But David yesterday made that point. Black faces in high places do nothing to change and reorder systems. Neither of them worked to do that and to create the necessary changes that are demanded and that are required. If there's even a rudimentary commitment to this thing we call justice. Because that means you would be looking sharply, not just at police and this nebulous thing called training. You'd be looking with a very serious intention of prosecuting people and putting them in jail, making them pay like any other citizen would pay for committing these kinds of crimes. And you certainly will make an effort to indicate that as the highest authority in the world of prosecution in the United States, you do intend to enforce laws that are on the books. You do intend to guarantee and assure the constitutional protections of the law to all citizens alike. and that you have the power and the authority to do so, and that's what you will do. And that includes shining a very, very hot light on the prosecutor's office, on detectives, the whole shebang. How do these cases so routinely produce the exact same result with remarkable regularity? And how dare anybody suggest that this is not at all connected with race? And this is why the people who come from communities that they recognize as being under siege, as being under attack, as experiencing this particular crisis that seems almost unique to them, it is incumbent upon that community to mobilize itself and to destroy. I want you to understand this word I'm saying, destroy the Democratic Party. Just simply to say, guess what? You won't get away with this. You are the system. You are in a position of making a difference. You're not responding. We will destroy you. Now, that seems perfectly fine to me. That is democracy. That is democracy. They're playing games literally with our lives, and you should have no emotional need to save them when your lives and the lives of the people of your community are on the line in this way. And this system in each of these cities, we find that we have a preponderance of Democratic officials whose job it is to respond as if this is in fact a crisis and as if in fact they are responsible. They are directly responsible. And in as much as they can't muster the muscle and the resolve to get this done, you will assist them by destroying their party. Just walk away from it completely. Leave it in shambles. Become unpredictable and leverage the power that you have to compel them to do what needs to be done, since that is the way it has to be. Since you have to inform them and do this now, we're tired of doing this nonsense for how many decades? How many more decades are people prepared to stage demonstrations and call for rational responses and to call for justice and all that stuff? Stop talking. Stop the talking. And do something dramatic in proportion to the level and intensity of suffering and oppression. Destroy the Democratic Party. That's my theme. I urge you to do that. Bring it to its knees. It is complicit, and it must be seen as complicit in directly complicit in your oppression. And why the Democratic Party? Because, pardon the pun, black folks are just slavishly loyal to it. For what reason, I don't know. It is the party of the slavocracy of the South. But for some reason, black folks and the minions who call themselves leaders are emotionally tied to it. And even as it completely ignores them and does them in, by acts of omission and acts of commission, there is still this slavish loyalty to the party. Break from it and destroy it. That's what you ought to do. Teach it a lesson. The number, as I said, is 888-874-4888. Let's talk about 2015. What emerged for you as the major issues of this year? How are we to gird ourselves for 2016? Not as the objects of action, but as the initiators of action, as in fact activists. How do we do that in 2015, given what we have witnessed in how do we do this in 2016, given what we have witnessed in 2015, the experience we have acquired, the knowledge we have acquired, and hopefully the will to create change? 888-874-4888. Let's start with Berkeley. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello, wonderful you, Therese.
Hello, Harvey. How are you?
Very good. Well, I'd like to pick up on your theme, and I'd like to talk about the climate talks in Paris. And, you know, they've pretty much let us know that we're getting into a dangerous zone here with the heating up of the planet and that we have to make a change or we're going to face serious consequences. And I have an idea that we can all take part in to help cool the planet down. And in the not-too-distant past, people used to live in villages and towns, and outside of these villages and towns were fields where fresh fruits and vegetables would be grown, and the fresh produce would be harvested and carted into the villages and towns. Freshness was the name of the game. You got it that day. And I'm sure in the marketplaces, that's what it was all about. And today, in America's finest restaurants, it's all about the freshest of ingredients. Freshness is everything. Well, it turns out that a lot of the produce that we eat is around 2 weeks or more old by the time we buy it. And one of the big supermarket chains here in California, they truck the fresh produce from the farm fields to a central warehouse in Arizona, where the food is stored and some of it is processed and redistributed to their stores throughout the state, the western states. And by the time the food hits the store shelves, it's traveled many, many miles, and it's not really truly fresh. And unfortunately, these fruits and vegetables also carry what we call a carbon footprint. The fossil fuels used in the trucking the produce around, the energy it takes to refrigerate the produce in warehouses and stores, and also the dealing with spoilage and waste. It all takes a lot of energy, and the whole system is fossil fuel intensive. And fruits and vegetables that are flown in from around the world carry an even larger carbon footprint. So here's my idea to make really fresh organic fruits and vegetables available to all of us, and that has very little carbon footprint, and they're called solar electric greenhouses on top of supermarkets. So these the supermarkets can be reinforced or superstructures could be built where you actually have solar electric greenhouses. And the reason I say solar electric is because they make solar electric glass now. This is glass that's transparent and at the same time produces electricity. So these solar electric greenhouses could be put on top of supermarkets, and they can use that photovoltaic that's light to electricity glass to supply energy to the drip irrigation systems inside the greenhouses, and they could vary the louvres. They can run the louvres to control the greenhouse temperatures and LED lighting, and they can even have atmospheric water harvesters, which would harvest water out of the atmosphere and be used to drip irrigate onto the fresh fruits and vegetables, and would have no carbon footprint, and the food would be delivered daily right down into the stores as it's harvested. When it's ready, it goes right down, and they can claim, yes, it is fresh, it's right off our rooftop here, and it would all be organically grown, and that way it would really help to dramatically reduce the carbon footprint. It didn't travel hundreds of miles like that cabbage or that kale that's sitting there, and it would be truly fresh, full of nutrition. So I think that we can all take part in eating locally grown fresh organic fruits and vegetables from the solar electric greenhouses on appropriate supermarkets and warehouses inside the city. Yeah.
It's always fascinating hearing your ideas, Harvey, and I thank you for contributing today and getting us started.
Thank you, Wonder, for you, Trace.
Thank you. From Ohio, Caroline, you're on the air. Oh, Caroline, I think we lost you. 888-874-4888 is a number to call. Well, the reason I talked about these things and the reason that we have discussed these cases in the way that we have discussed these cases, and I'm guaranteeing you they were not discussed this way elsewhere in such detail, but it's to take a look at how systems work. And this system is so important in maintaining this relationship of who is governed and how they are to be governed. Let's go to Los Angeles. DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing okay. A little bit upset here for a couple of reasons. First of all, good morning from California to all the PRN listeners.
Thank you.
I had a couple of things I wanted to talk about. One of them is kind of related to what Harvey was talking about. I don't know if you've heard of this, but apparently since October, there's been a methane leak out here in Los Angeles in a section that we call Porter Ranch, which is in the San Fernando Valley. Los Angeles. It's an affluent area, you know, very high-income people live there. And apparently, this thing has been spewing methane into the air since October. And Sempra Energy, which is the energy company out here, is saying that it's going to be another couple of months before they can tap this thing or shut it off. And it's spewing approximately about 110,000 pounds of methane into the air every hour. Now, I just found out about this a couple of days ago. I'm going, wow, this is a lot of methane. Right now, it's accounting for about 25% of California's total emissions at this point, which is astounding to me. Have you heard about that at all?
No, I haven't, actually.
Yes, it's been on the news every day, apparently, but I don't watch regular TV, so I just heard about it a couple of days ago. It's terrible. This thing is like, but of course in the mainstream media, they're handling it like it's no big deal. Yeah, I would like for people to just go ahead and take a look at that and try to find out some information on this. It's terrible. I mean, it's polluting the skies like crazy. They got people. They had to move a substantial number of people out of the area. And apparently Sempra Energy didn't let anybody know what was going on at first, and all kinds of people and their kids got sick, reported to the hospital. And they moved about approximately 2,500 people out of the area and are apparently paying for them to rent apartments and things like that. And the landlords are totally taking advantage. People are paying up to $8,000 a month for apartments. So, and one last fact on that. I believe the reason why they're not hurrying to do anything about it is because the governor, Jerry Brown, has very strong ties with Sempra Energy. His sister apparently works for them and makes about $181,000 a year. Also, they're very heavy contributors to his campaign when he ran last time. He's received tens of thousands of dollars from them. And so this is why this is being covered up and they're not talking about it and not doing anything about it. I just thought that was just amazing that all this methane is just floating up into the air. And they even have infrared images online. People can look at it, this thing, you know, spewing this stuff in the air. So,
I'll take a look at that.
Yeah,
but
so
take us to 2015 and what has emerged for you as a central issue.
Well, of course, the central issue, you know, I, like Dr. Cornel West, start on the black side of town because I do believe that what affects us, you know, is going to affect everybody who doesn't have money or power eventually, of course. And I don't know if you heard about this, but Chicago police over the weekend assassinated two more people.
Yes.
You did hear, yes. Apparently, Northern Illinois University student named Quintonio LeGreer was home on vacation visiting his father, and he is a bright kid too, electrical engineer. He was studying in college, you know, and he's home. So apparently, he has a few little mental issues, and father got worried about him, and he's walking around with an aluminum bat or something, and his father's trying to calm him down. So he felt like he needed to call the police in. So right after he calls the police, he calls his neighbor from downstairs, 55-year-old woman named Betty Jones, and asks her if she'll come up and let the police in when they get there. So they get there. She opens the door for them. Right, almost immediately, but shortly after that, the son starts coming, running down the stairs with the bat in hand. Right now, they don't have a lot of details, but the police are saying that he charged at them with the bat. We all know that that probably is going to turn out to not be really true. So they just start opening fire. Not only do they shoot this young man, 19 years old, 7 times, once in the buttocks, which means he was running away at some point. But they also shoot this 55-year-old woman in the chest, and she dies immediately. Now, this nonsense here, first of all, I don't know why we as a people, black people, Hispanics, don't realize that bringing the police into a situation like this is only going to make it worse. And we need to stop being so quick to dial 911. Me personally, that would be my last resort. You know what I mean? If nothing else worked. But, I mean, that's my last resort at this point. I will not call the cops to my house at all, almost for any reason. Also, another thing I wanted to say about that
here's an issue. The police are public servants.
They are.
That's what they're there for. And you know, I've covered many cases where emotionally disturbed people or people who are having mental meltdowns or for whatever reason are just, maybe they didn't take their medications and so forth, ended up dead. For no reason other than the police had a quick access to a lethal weapon, and they chose to, even though in each instance they were clear that they were responding to an emotionally disturbed person call, an EDP call. I know many, many officers on the force who tell me time and again, there are all these different ways of dealing with this, all these different ways of responding to an emotionally disturbed person. It's not simply just to shoot them dead for being guilty of having a mental problem. You see, I remember the case of Eleanor Bumpers, a woman who they wanted to evict
in New York.
And 67 years old and going on 68 years old, and she ends up with a huge hole in her chest from a double-barreled shotgun and from a SWAT team. And this was deemed the appropriate response to carrying out an eviction.
Right.
So, or Anthony Baez, who is shot. He is above the police officers on a fire escape, and they deemed him on a fire escape to be a threat to them on the street below. He's shot and killed. Or there's a case of Daddy Boy, a Jamaican young man who, again, did not take his medication. His elderly parents didn't feel that they could calm him down physically. They didn't have it to calm him down because he was in a frenetic state. Police officers walk into the apartment responding to this call. Next thing you know, I saw the apartment myself, as I did with the bumpers. I mean, just the apartment riddled with bullet holes. And this is what they call appropriate response. The officers feared for their lives. You know, so at some point, we have to say, what is causing these officers to feel unduly threatened when they know they are responding to an emotional emotionally disturbed person call? And just the same, they have the attitude that they have the power and authority to just dispatch that person at their will. This is absolutely wrong.
I'm not sure that they always just feel threatened. I think what we're seeing here, as David pointed out yesterday, this is the way the system is designed to work. You just pointed out a few cases, several cases, from years and years ago. I mean, this is, the thing is now we have more ways of knowing when these things happen. We have people with, everyone has a cell phone with a camera, so we know about it. But this is the way this system is designed to work. I mean, way from when they encounter a black person, it's different, all the way from there to when they're acquitted or when they're not charged. This is the way the system is designed to work. And the only thing we can do is try to change this. We got to get a hold of this.
Well, I don't think we, you know, I have even revised this thing long ago. I don't think we have to try anymore to change anything. It has demonstrated its imperviousness to change. What people have to do is change themselves. Change your attitude. Change your understanding of reality. And change your actions. Change it. You can't change that system. Give up on it. It's not going to change. But you can't change you, and you can't change your attitude, and you can change your resolve that this is not going to happen anymore. It just is not going to happen. That's where we want to engage. Thanks, DX, for calling today and for contributing. From Delaware, Macho, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon. Ms. Detrice, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm so happy to hear your voice. I have sent you an email that brought you some peanuts from Ghana.
Oh, okay. I now recognize who you are.
I need an address to send it to you. I'm so happy. I came back and I was so happy to hear your voice.
Thank you. Your voice sounds
so strong. I'm so happy to hear you.
Thank you. So what emerged for you in 2015 as something very, very important that you would like to share with us?
What event for me? Well, basically, I think that what I've taken away from everything happening this year is that this country is not really meant for black people. It's all an illusion when you don't live here, when you're not from here, because I'm originally from Ghana.
Okay, how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, with everything I see going on, you know, with the police, and I also see it's very hard from the native blacks to get anywhere in this country. It's actually easier for me as a foreigner to make it than, you know, the ones who have been here longer than I have.
Could you think of a particular thing that you would advise people to be aware of, and how they can make a difference or change with respect to this very problem that you were talking about in 2016?
Well, I would advise them to do what I do. I save for everything I get. And my house is fully paid for. My vehicle is fully paid for. Everything I buy, I actually work and save money. I have my money in a credit union, but I don't take any loans. I don't have any credit cards. You know, just live according to your means and stay away from the police. I think that's the advice I have for them.
Live within your means, and basically, if you can't afford it, don't buy it.
Don't buy it. Just live within your means. Whatever you can afford, stick with your means, and you'll be fine. Because then you don't owe anyone anything.
I think that's very sound advice. Thank you so much. Thank you very much for contributing today.
I love you so much, please.
I'm sorry?
I said I love you and stay strong.
Thank you so much for your very kind thoughts. I appreciate them greatly. Thank you. 888-874-4888. That's sound advice. And it is as old as the hills. In Trinidad, there's a saying, don't hang your hat where your hand can't reach it. Meaning, stay within your means. Just don't hang your hat where your hand can't reach it. It means that you're asking for trouble. You're trying to do something that is inevitably going to backfire. You're just asking for big trouble. Stay within your means. From Brooklyn, we hear again from David. Thank you for calling.
Oh, this is a different David. I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a different David. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you're doing well.
Thank you so much.
And I don't like to bring up any bad things, but I miss Robert Knight immeasurably, but thanks to you, it's mitigated a little bit.
Thanks. What emerged for you as a major issue to ponder or for us to pay attention to so that we could learn something from that occurred in 2015?
Well, it's not really anything that can't learn from you. It's especially the word you said at the beginning, the slavocracy. It's white supremacy is pretty much alive and well in the Northeast. I was exposed to a white supremacist bigot, and it's not pretty. I just wanted to let you know that.
Okay.
I hate even to say this. He called me a nigger lover. I said, so? Apparently you're a bigot. That was the end of that conversation. Because he was just berating black people like crazy. It's alive and well. It's not just in the South, and you know that.
How do you think this problem could be tackled by somebody, let's say, coming into his or her own as a politically savvy person as an activist in 2016?
Well, always ask the good, hard questions.
We have some construction going on here.
It's coming through loud and clear.
Okay, I'm hearing you now.
Oh, good. She was saying about, like Gary was saying about activists, they shouldn't be like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. Everybody really has to get together, and that includes white people who aren't racist or bigots. It's going to be a really hard movement with the corporatocracy in charge.
How's that going to happen then?
Another good one. Anyway, everybody has a social media. They could get together with that. I'm not one of them because I'm already being followed on the phone and the TV. I don't need to be followed on a computer, too, or a smartphone. So I listen to you on a daily basis on this landline. So I think it has to be a social media movement.
Do you think bigotry, white supremacy, is sufficiently tamed in the United States?
No.
Under control?
Absolutely not. Not under control. Absolutely not. You know that yourself. The police killing mainly black people. It's not really under control. And the police are all part of the whole thing. And some of them are unwilling participants yet.
Do you think whites see that there's a vested interest, they have a vested interest in confronting racism, and talking about it, and more importantly, doing something about it the way you apparently have.
No, because a lot of people are just struggling just to get by, so they don't want to bother with anything else, because it's not in their circle of life. Their circle of life is paying the rent and the bills and whatever, and everything's going up, and a possibility of a world war. I think it's inevitable, but I don't know what your opinion on that is.
Well, it certainly looks like we're moving toward it, and people are all gung-ho for it in this election cycle. They're cheering it on.
I can't watch that charade. They're not even talking to mainly the people. They're talking to the ones that are going to give them all the money for their run for the presidency. I learned that a bunch of years ago.
In 2016, this presidential election year, how does this now play into the immediate future? What would the racial climate be if we don't have as many whites participating in the deconstruction of white supremacy?
More of the same. More killing with the police and the blacks and Latinos, especially the blacks. I don't know what it is. Black folks seem to be getting the brunt of everything, as usual.
Well, thank you very much, David, for calling today and for contributing. Let's go to Baltimore. Marie, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
I like what you said in the beginning about Arthur Pyde or Arthur Pete or whatever and white supremacy. I'm going to quote something that Malcolm said. There's no such thing as a bloodless revolution. And I think the United States is prime for a revolution. And, but the forces that be will probably prefer a race riot as opposed to a revolution. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening to you.
And, I mean, if you disagree or agree, you know, I don't mind. But
I'm listening to have you flesh out your idea so that we can get a comprehensive appreciation for where you're going.
And, well, I'm going to mention something I had heard on another radio station not too long ago. And they mentioned that when Rick Nixon was alive, he had a discussion with Kissinger about decreasing the population of the world. And you see that now, oh, I forgot to say this, that they agreed that they should start in Africa to depopulate the population in Africa first. And I think that what's going on now is we see that in Africa, and we also see that here. They want to kill all the black people. And
the
black people are perplexed. They don't know what to do. They're worried and upset. And there's white people here that don't like us and don't mind us being killed. And so that's all I have to say, and thank you so much.
But let me ask you a couple of questions now. If these things are evident to you and apparent to you, and assuming that they are apparent and evident to others as well, what, therefore, is accounting for the fact that we don't have resolution?
Well, you know, we could talk about these things, but there's no action. They talk with the indigenous Indians, and that didn't get them anywhere. And so there has to be a revolution. I mean, I can't see it any other way. And I know I'm probably speaking kind of dangerously, but I'm going to say what I feel.
This revolution, is it going to be violent? Is it going to be armed revolution? Is it going to be an out-and-out war?
It will not be, according to Malcolm, a bloodless revolution, sad to say. And you can't talk to the people at the top. They're in power, and they don't want to lose their power, naturally. And so the talking stage is over with. So it goes into action now.
And as you see it...
Pardon me?
Who will be attacking whom? Who will be the principal participants in this revolution? If you can identify the groups or the classes, or how would its revolution express itself?
Well, it probably will be a racial confrontation. Gary Null had mentioned that before Freddie Gray got killed, because the people in this country are programmed to dislike darker-skinned people. We'll be the boogeyman. And Donald Trump doesn't like lower-class people, and that includes white people. And those white people don't seem to understand that Donald Trump doesn't care for them. You know? And so, I really don't have any answers to your question. And I think we're in a very dangerous situation over here. And I thought to myself, too, before I called you up, I think we ought to tell tourists from outside this country, don't come here. Boycott this country.
And why should they do that?
Huh?
Why should they do that?
Because this country here deals with money. They like money here. And so if we tell the people who want to come here just to visit, I'm not speaking about the immigrants, tell them don't come to this country. Don't go to Disneyland. And don't go to other places that we in America like to go to. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm interested in how you are seeing things, but I'm all the more interested in what the markers for you have been. What would you say have been the indicators that we have to deal with this as a possible reality, that there could come a time, and it might be sooner than we think,
mm-hmm.
that we will basically have to deal with this confrontation? It wouldn't be, by the way, historically speaking, it wouldn't be the first time that there have been race wars in the United States. It certainly will not be the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, what would you say would have precipitated this if it were to come to that?
What would come to a race war? Did you ask?
Yes. What would have triggered?
Well, the fact that would trigger in this country, I don't know about other countries, is that in this country, there's always a boogeyman of some sort. That's the fault that you don't have a job or you don't have other things. And they fall for that. There's always got to be a boogeyman, according to the people at the top. They want to convince us that there's a boogeyman. That's why you don't have this or that. And it wouldn't be hard to promote a race war.
And you're seeing evidence of that happening now?
I think so, with the white policemen mostly shooting black people. And this is going to cause others, like the case of Zimmerman. He wasn't a policeman, but just felt that he had to shoot a black person. And we're devalued in this country. And in the Hall of Records in Maryland, when we were brought over here, and not many people know this, we were called black gold. Did you know that?
Yes, I do. Yes.
You knew that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, a lot of people in this country, including my race, they don't know that. From gold race, I mean, from gold, black gold to what we are now, we're no longer gold. We're no longer valued. So they want to get rid of us. So you entice the lower class white people to do damage to us, killing us, whatever, and so forth. It would not be hard to start a race war here. Look at the case back in 1943 in Detroit, I believe. They had a race riot on a bridge. The white Southerners from the South had a riot with the black people who came from the South, too. All goes back to economics. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening very intently. I listen hard to what people are saying because I want to fully appreciate the depth of what you are saying. And you are putting together for us a pretty stark picture of what is possible, what can happen. And you're not the only one thinking this way, I must tell you. And you must know also there are a lot of people who are seeing this as a clear possibility of where we are headed as a country.
Mm-hmm.
And the question now becomes, if this is the conclusion that you've come to, if this is what you see on the horizon, what therefore does this mean in the short term? How do you deal with this in anticipation of what could happen? What is the proper thing to do now?
Well, I walk around in this country where I live too, watching my back. I feel like I have to be on guard. And whether I should carry a gun or not, I really don't want to go that way. But I feel like I have to be on an alert and try to bone up on rules and regulations that won't put me into jeopardy because I don't trust this country as far as I'm concerned. And, if I get into some legal problems, I feel I may have a harder sentence than a white person. And I heard that lady who wrote the play or something called Orange to Black or something like that, she was asked about white people's time in jail. And someone called up and said that they had someone who went to jail and her jail sentence was twice as long as a white person. And I just see this country is, we're in a war zone right now. Well, right now, we're in a war zone.
You're not the only one who feels this way. It is very sobering to hear it. But I assure you, there are many, many people feeling this way about the reality that they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Marie, for sharing this today.
And thank you for letting me talk. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of the program today. Stay tuned. The Infectious Myth with David Crow is up next. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. We will continue this conversation till the end of the year. A pleasure and a great privilege, and I mean that, to be in your company. Thank you. See you tomorrow.